This case is A211236, the State of Minnesota versus Christian Anthony Paul Ruth.
Good morning. I want to say a couple of things before we begin. First of all, thank you very much for being willing to participate remotely today. We are going to follow the same rules that we otherwise would follow if we were in person, but there are some things I'd like to make some comments about. So first off, we ask that you, when you're not speaking, turn off your mic or mute yourself. And that way there's not any background noise or echoing or that kind of thing on our remote argument. Also, only the attorneys and the judges are able to present their screens and speak today. So we've disabled those other functions. We are also making a recording, an audio recording of the proceeding. So if you would state your name and the party that you represent before beginning, and no other recordings are permitted of the proceedings today. I want to say a comment about the clock as well, and that is that we found that depending on whether you're an active speaker view or gallery view, the size of that clock will change. So to make sure that you see how much time is remaining, we recommend that you stay in gallery view as opposed to the active speaker view. And last, we understand that from time to time, there might be interruptions, technical difficulties or glitches. And if something like that happens, please let us know right away and we will do what we can to accommodate it. We are going to do what we can also to keep those interruptions on our end to a minimum, whether those are pets or doorbells or children, and ask that you do the same. And with that, I think we're prepared to begin argument. Attorney for appellant, Ms. Graff.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Leah Graff, and I represent the appellant, Christian Ruth. In this second-degree DWI matter, Ruth asks this court to reverse the district court's denial of his motion to dismiss and vacate his conviction. Ruth requests this relief because it is fundamentally unfair to revoke his driver's license and to use that prior revocation to enhance a DWI when, at the time of the revocation and during the time to seek judicial review of the revocation, he was experiencing severe symptoms of psychosis that rendered him unable to understand the nature and wrongfulness of his conduct. The due process concerns that Ruth raises are twofold. First, Ruth was denied due process in the prior revocation process itself. Second, the state's use of the prior revocation violated Ruth's right to due process in the current criminal prosecution. It is my goal this morning to address both violations of Ruth's due process rights. The first issue I would address is the issue with his due process rights in the prior revocation proceeding. To bring this type of collateral challenge to the constitutionality of a prior revocation, the defendant must inform the state that his rights were violated in the prior revocation and produce evidence in support of that contention. Here, Ruth did that. He filed a motion to dismiss, argued for collateral attack of the prior revocation on due process grounds, and also presented the 2018 order of the district court finding him not guilty by reason of mental illness, as well as the findings of the 2018 Rule 20 in his briefing to the district court in support of those contentions.
Ms. Graff, I'd just like to talk about the Rule 20 evaluation. That, of course, was not made part of the record during the proceedings below, right?
Correct.
And you are now asking this court to take judicial notice of that evaluation after having been denied the request that was made to supplement the record by the district court. And I'm just wondering what authority you have for us to take judicial notice, not only of the ultimate finding in the Rule 20 evaluation, but also of the specific contents of that evaluation, which was performed in a completely different file.
So I guess I will start by saying that I want to make it clear that even if this court declines to take judicial notice of that evaluation in a different district court file, the information, the substantive content that's relevant to Ruth's claims is is before the court. So it's not necessary for this court to do so. The substantive content was contained in Roof's briefings. The district court, although it denied the motion to supplement with the evaluation itself, said, "I considered the findings as represented by Roof below." The state didn't dispute them and has never done so. So
just to stop you there,
yeah.
When you talk about the substantive finding that is properly before us, are you referring to the fact that for the purpose of the 2002 evaluation, the examiner concluded that he was not able to appreciate the criminality of his actions? Or is there something else substantive that you think is properly before us, judicial notice issue aside?
Certainly. So the Ruth's memorandum to the court discussed that ultimate opinion about criminal responsibility. It also discussed his history of hospitalization, the fact that the Rule 20 evaluation was ordered with respect to multiple court files across a sort of specified period of time ranging from, I believe, August 2017 until May of 2018. So all of that information was presented to the district court. And we know that the district court here was considering more than just really like the ultimate judicial finding, because when the district court talked about the evaluation, it referred to Dr. Wigner's evaluation and the date of the interview with Ruth and his mental status at that time, which would be sort of the underlying facts in the evaluation set forth by Dr. Wigner. And I would just note too that the evaluation was submitted to the district court in the other matter by stipulation as part of a stipulated facts trial. So not in this proceeding has the state objected to consideration of that factual, those historical facts, but didn't dispute them and stipulated to their submission to the court in the prior proceeding as well. So I think bringing it back to the point that regardless of whether this court takes judicial notice of that evaluation, the relevant substantive conduct was presented, was considered by the district court, and was not subject to dispute at this point or at any other point.
Okay. So if I can ask a question too that relates to this, because there's the two different types of Rule 20 motions. And if someone is found competent under 2001, I guess that's really the question we're struggling with here. What impact does that determination have on whether or not we can essentially excuse a missed deadline? So maybe you can explain. It seems like you're asking us to find some new standard, right? So you have competency, and then you've got the 2002 standard that relates to a specific time period. And then in between that, it seems like you're saying something that is a person can be competent under 2001, but still there's a basis to excuse missing a deadline due to the impact of mental illness, right? So what is that precise middle ground or standard that you're asking us to create or carve out here?
So I think I want to clarify two things. I'm not asking the court to create a new standard for purposes of addressing the constitutionality of the revocation or the constitutionality of its use in the criminal proceeding. The claims are due process claims, and the law on that has been presented and I think is clear in terms of the Matthews factors. I think it's tempting to import the 2001 competency and 2002 mental illness defense sort of divisions into this inquiry, but I think to the extent it's relevant, it actually supports Ruth's claims because of what Your Honor said, which is the question here is about the revocation and the period following that revocation, and essentially looking at whether Ruth was effectively denied the opportunity for judicial review. And a competency determination is necessarily capturing a moment in time, typically comes later as the criminal court process goes forward. It doesn't relate back to a previous moment in time, such as the time of the revocation, the time of the offense. Here we actually have a great deal of information about the not only the time of the revocation, the conduct that gave rise to the revocation, but a whole window of time that envelops from the revocation to the time that the period for judicial review expired. And so in that sense, the court doesn't need to create a new standard for revocation. It just needs to consider those facts in the context of the due process analysis. I think it bears most clearly on the likelihood of erroneous deprivation and the effective denial of review.
Well, that, I guess that if I could follow up, when we get to that second Matthews factor, I wondered what the deprivation could be post-Axelberg. As I read the statute and the scope of that hearing, maybe I misread it, and there is a provision specifically allowing someone to raise essentially a 2002 defense in that civil administrative proceeding. But if it's not there, if the legislature didn't specify that that is a part of the scope of the hearing, post-Axelberg, how could there be any deprivation?
So the question of whether the statute permits a sort of Rule 20-like defense in the revocation process does not bear directly on the risk of erroneous deprivation. And that's for two reasons. I think, well, one, when you look at the case law that's addressing that Matthews factor, whether it's the collateral context or the more sort of direct due process context like in Wilkin, the court's not looking at the merits of the underlying claims that the appellant or the defendant is proposing to assert in the other proceeding. They're looking at the circumstances that led to the unreviewed status. So in Hino versus 1-2003 Cadillac, the court said, you know, we think that the risk is minimal because the party filed the petition and then I believe in that case voluntarily withdrew the petition. So it's not looking at the merits. It's just looking at the circumstances that led to the current status of the revocation. And I think that the sort of second part of my answer is that is because we don't want to reverse engineer procedural due process. We don't want to look at what's the merits, what's the outcome of the merits of the claims here, and therefore it's okay that you were denied the procedural due process. The question is sort of the likelihood of erroneous deprivation given the procedures that did or didn't happen.
There has to be some way we consider whether there's any potential to rescind the revocation, right? We just can't be completely blind to that. If it's a completely frivolous basis that might exist to rescind the revocation, does it make any sense under this factor? It seems like the factor would include some look at the merits.
I don't think that there are any cases in this realm that do that. And I think that it's because of the procedural due process nature of the claim and evaluation of whether the procedures were constitutionally sufficient, not a hypothetical determination of outcomes of procedures that didn't occur. So I would stand by that answer that the case law supports the analysis that Ruth has put forth here, which doesn't delve into what precisely the merits of any claims he would have had the process occurred.
I'm just hoping to take you back to the discussion that we had a few moments ago, I think initiated by Judge Bryan, about sort of the difference between a 2001 evaluation and a 2002 evaluation and the standards that are being applied in those two contexts. It seems to me that you are asking us to extrapolate from the 2002 conclusions in the case a determination that Mr. Ruth necessarily wasn't competent, which is a different inquiry. And I'm just wondering if you could help me figure out how we could do that, legally speaking, or just even analytically speaking.
So the court doesn't have to make a finding of competency akin to what happens in a criminal case. And it's not just the finding of not guilty by reason of mental illness that the court has to work with here. So we have that finding in the prior DWI matter that was connected to the license revocation. We also have, again, all the information that was submitted to the district court, which is that across this time period from August of 2017 until May of 2018, in multiple files, there were acquittals on mental illness grounds. And there was no stabilization in his mental health status. And during the period within which he could have sought judicial review of the revocation, we know that he was hospitalized in an inpatient setting during at least part of that time. So it isn't simply importing the finding and just resting solely on that. It's an overall view of this time period, which makes this case incredibly unique. And all of those things then just need to be considered in the light of the Matthews balancing factors. And so there's no determination of incompetency. It's simply fitting it into the framework of the due process question. And I think that, I think that the dicta in Anderson sort of suggests like that there are legitimate concerns when if a person's mental health status was such that there may be a due process problem with revocation or with use of that revocation. In either way, I think there's overlap under the likelihood of erroneous deprivation factor. And so I think that is this case and that is this record, which again is highly unique and really addresses an important time period. I see that my time is up.
Thank you very much, Ms. Knapp.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, Ms. Graff, my former moot court partner. Very fun to see her. My name is Cecilia Knapp. I'm an assistant county attorney for Clay County, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this case. I wanted to start with the appellant has not met their burden of production to prove that his mental health status totally precluded him from petitioning for review during that entire 60-day time period. And that's like the panel has noted, because we don't have the 2002 evaluation in the record, and without it, he cannot prevail. The panel should not take judicial notice of the evaluation. I address this in a footnote in my brief. I'd also add there's, of course, Rule 2802, but then also a number of somewhat recent decisions by this court confirming what the record on appeal consists of. And those decisions have been talking about guilty plea withdrawals. But in those cases, we can see how this court has taken a tough stance on the interpretation of the rule that if you didn't introduce whatever document at the hearing to withdraw the guilty plea, then you don't get to refer to it at a later date. If it's not on the record at the initial hearing, it's not in the appeal record. So without that evaluation, the appellant's argument is based on speculation, and that's an inadequate showing, again, that he was unable to pursue an implied consent hearing during the entirety of the 60-day period.
So I think that it's a little more, in my view, nuanced or complicated than that, because there is some stipulation on behalf of the state. There are some facts that seem to be stipulated, at least in one or the other. And it would seem like the state would have to stand by those factual stipulations even here. In portions of appellant's brief, they characterize this as a case without any factual dispute. So perhaps it would make sense for you to explain which facts are you disputing from that evaluation or report? Or maybe framed alternatively, are you conceding that during those 60 days, there was some determination of incompetency?
I would say we can't dispute the fact that there was this evaluation, that there is this court order out there saying he was found not guilty by reason of mental illness. But I think because of the district court's explicit decision refusing to supplement the record, then we are limited by that. And representations in briefs without an affidavit or any of the other support I kind of ran through in my second footnote, then the appellant has not met their burden of proof. I'd also like to point out that this is an error correcting court, and here there's been no error by the district court to correct. The district court properly applied the existing statute, 169A53, mandating that these types of petitions be filed within 60 days. That statute, it's been held, provides constitutionally adequate due process procedures. That's the Coleman decision, the Goharba-Wong decision, that our implied consent statutes in Minnesota meet Mendoza-Lopez. And so what the appellant is asking for basically is for this court to create a new constitutional defense on the civil side of a matter used to enhance a criminal prosecution, but new or revised constitutional interpretations, major policy changes, that's for the Supreme Court or the legislature, not the role of this error correcting court.
Ms. Knapp, before we get to, and I think that there are some implications along the lines of what you're saying. But before I get to that, I guess if I were to characterize the error argued below, it would be that the district court uses the determination of competency on, I believe it's June 7, 2018, that the district court sort of extrapolates from that determination that therefore during the period of appeal or the period in which there could have been a request for judicial review of the administrative decision on revocation, that because of the competency decision on June 7th, therefore there was some degree or sufficient degree of competency during that 60-day period. And it seems that's the argument that I see from appellant, is that that decision, that extrapolation is erroneous. So I do think that there's alleged error here that we're supposed to look at, and maybe you could address why you think it was proper for the district court to infer from a June 7th determination of incompetency something about the competency in the range of, I believe it's February through April.
I think that very well could have been a mistake in fact, in terms of the court kind of conflating or not keeping the dates correct. But I think we need to remember, though, that the court did, in fact, at the very root of the issue, apply 169A and that very strict jurisdictional time bar correctly. I think what's also important to know is that if we adopt the appellant's position, you could extrapolate it to a situation where, say, somebody gets into a coma. So they're arrested for DWI, then they are released and they get into a car accident the day or 2 days later, and then they get into a coma for that entire 60-day time period. And under the appellant's position, they could claim a due process violation, even though there was no action or procedure by the state that was involved in that. And so that really stretches the boundaries of due process too far. Here, there was no constitutionally defective government process or state action that prevented the appellant from petitioning for review. You know, there's no evidence that 169A53 wasn't followed. The appellant was given an opportunity for review. And this is not a case like Wiltkin, where the obstacle was the district court's standing order that really interfered with that driver's ability to petition for review. So I think what the appellant is asking is just taking due process as we recognize it too far. And we need to recognize or remember that due process in the civil arena is different from in the criminal arena. Our law is very clear in distinguishing the constitutional difference in due process between a civil matter and a criminal matter. And for example, in the Anderson decision back from 2016, the court noted, yes, revocation proceedings, you do get due process protections, but the protections are less stringent than those afforded to criminal defendants. And then in the Haino or Hino decision, H-E-I-N-O, the court again noted that due process protections in the civil context are different from those in the criminal context. So what we're looking at really is a hearing. Due process in terms of driver's license revocations requires a hearing. And the issue in the Anderson case and like today is, was a driver afforded the process they were due? Yes, that's what 169A53 sets forth, and that's what happened here. I think in my brief, I also highlight the differences, the important differences between due process in the civil arena and the criminal arena. And the law is clear. I think we kind of touched on this previously. The law has been very clear in terms of what you can raise or argue when you're challenging a license revocation. And you can't raise anything that's not enumerated in the statute. There's no defense based on a driver's mental state.
Ms. Knapp, I am wondering, so Judge Brian asked Ms. Graff a question about the effect of Axelberg on our consideration of the issue in this case. And she suggested that it would not be appropriate for us to look at whether Mr. Ruth may have prevailed in a context of what's allowed to be litigated under the statute and the restrictions of Axelberg. Do you agree with her response there? I mean, it sounds like you don't. And if not, why would it be appropriate for us to say, you know, he wouldn't have prevailed anyway?
In full transparency, I'm not as familiar with Axelberg, so I probably won't be very helpful to the court, but I do believe that we do need to consider, keep in mind the differences between 2001 and 2002, and then also we need to remember how the goal of the limited basis of collateral attacks is to prevent damage and uphold the finality of administrative proceedings. And
If I threw you off with Axelberg. So Axelberg just basically says, you know, you are restricted when you challenge a license revocation to the grounds identified by statute. So, you know, you can challenge whether there's probable cause, et cetera. And competence, of course, is not one of those grounds. And I'm wondering if we even get there, or are we sort of prohibited from even going there in our analysis here?
Sure. I think I could answer that question by noting, taking a step back, the case law that the appellant cites doesn't actually support their petition or their argument. And so I don't know that we necessarily need to get there. I mean, I think it's persuasive or helpful to note that we shouldn't be allowing collateral attacks based on something that's not even allowed to be raised in the initial part of whatever we're talking about, but also noting how there really is no solid case law to support the appellant's petition. More generally speaking, all of the cases that they cite are very distinguishable. And I think that what that ultimately means is the facts of those cases aren't similar enough to justify a determination that mental health issues that might make pursuing an implied consent more difficult amount to a due process violation. And that kind of ties back to there being no error by the district court for this court to apply. So I'd also add, whether we're looking backwards at the implied consent stage or forwards in this subsequent TWI prosecution, really, I think the issue is the same. It's the burden of production, which again, I don't believe that the appellant has met. Even so, there's the distinction in due process between civil cases, which don't amount to the rigorous protections that we give criminal defendants. I think, returning to my COMA example, the violation of due process relates to some government action or process put in place by the government that has a constitutional deficit. Neither of those situations happened here. And then civil due process just doesn't go as far as the appellant argues it should go. Our courts have upheld that, you know, what's enough is notice and an opportunity to be heard, which is what 169A53 provides. And more generally speaking, our court has held and upheld our implied consent statutes to assure that the state's very important interest in protecting the public is not overlooked. And that's, we have to remember to the state's interest to protect the public from really the carnage that results on highways from drunken drivers. And those laws are to be liberally construed to protect the public. So I'd also finally like to conclude or highlight how rare collateral attacks are. The grounds for those are very limited. And really, it's been allowed mostly or almost exclusively in cases related to violations to the right to counsel. And they've never been allowed in a case such as the one before the court today. So keeping in mind the limited nature of collateral attacks, I think appellant's argument also fails. And so on that note, I'll just conclude that I would ask the court affirm the district court's decision denying the motion to dismiss. And that is all that I have, unless the panel has any further questions.
All right, thank you. I don't see any other questions from my colleagues, so we'll turn to rebuttal, Ms. Graff.
Thank you. I want to make a few points in rebuttal. The first is that the claims here don't ask this court to break new constitutional ground, to expand collateral attack jurisprudence. In Davis versus Commissioner, this court endorsed a collateral attack on due process grounds based on what occurred in a prior implied consent process and suggested that that was the means to address those concerns in the subsequent criminal prosecution. Again, even if there is no judicial notice of the 28 Rule 20, all of that relevant information was presented. The state didn't object in litigating this issue in the district court. The state has referred to the contents of the 28 Rule 20 before this court. And again, it was entered into the record in the prior proceeding by the state's stipulation. I also want to add that due process in a criminal case is a question before this court. So regardless of sort of the level of due process required, the second claim is, number one, not a collateral attack. So the court doesn't have to address any of those issues if it chooses not to, and can still rule in Ruth's favor, addressing whether the use of the revocation in this criminal case denied him due process. And that's entirely...
Sorry, Ms. Graff, I know that yes. Your time is limited. I'll try and keep it very quick and brief. But as far as we're looking at the distinction between the civil and the criminal side, are you arguing that any administrative process that does not include some exception to a deadline for mental illness, that it is a due process violation for the state to criminalize or to allow an enhancement based on that administrative process? So in other words, the process administratively is faulty because it doesn't allow for this exception to the 60 days, and therefore the process on the criminal side is a problem if you're allowing an enhancement that is based on that bad process on the administrative side. Is that essentially what you're arguing, or is there something more specific to the facts of this particular case?
The second thing, there is something more specific to the particular facts of this case. This court does not need to announce a broad rule about exceptions for mental illness issues in administrative proceedings. It only needs to say that in this case, under these circumstances, because due process is a flexible rule, that where we have the unique record we have in terms of his mental health status at the time of the revocation, preceding the revocation, subsequent to the revocation, that in this scenario, there's a due process problem with the state relying on that revocation to enhance. And it, to the extent there's a concern about sort of floodgates, I think the unique record here simply makes this case, it's not a floodgates case. If anything, it may help sort of narrow the window left open by that dicta in Anderson versus State, suggesting sort of an interplay between due process and mental health status. Because of the unique record here. I think that the only thing I would add is that in terms of the error by the district court, respondent has said that the court correctly applied the strict jurisdictional time bar under the DWI statutes. But in fact, the court did the opposite. The court said the evaluator thought he was able to handle his criminal case on June 7th when she interviewed him. And so at any point thereafter, he could have sought judicial review of the revocation. That's exactly contrary to the DWI statutes because respondent agrees at that point in time, the 60-day window for him to petition for judicial review had closed. So with all of those things in mind, I would ask this court to consider the unique facts and circumstances presented here, the traditional due process framework that the court is familiar with through both collateral and direct attacks, and reverse the district court's denial of the motion and vacate his conviction.
Okay, I don't see any questions from my colleagues, so I think we will conclude the argument, and I want to